for some of you who may not know, you will certainly know that she must have been married to a guy named Elliot. He was one of five that were killed in Ecuador in 1956. She had gone down there to work as a single missionary first and then married. The end results of that was that she stayed on as a missionary, eventually went in and lived with the Auca Indians who had killed the five men. And then in, 1962, she returned to this country mainly for the education of her daughter, who was then getting on to 8 years old. She felt that school was needed, and then when she came back to this country, while she spent her time in continuing her writing and speaking. After a while, she changed her name to Leach, marrying Addison Leach, who was a professor. Seems like she's had misfortune in the area of men. Being the first one got killed and the second one died. He had cancer, I guess, a couple years after their marriage, and his marriage only lasted 4 years and a couple of months. So far, I've managed to hang on for almost 9 years. And actually, I still feel pretty good. Got a few things going on. So I'm hoping that the spell has been broken and that we have some years left together. Anyway, it does indeed give me pleasure to introduce my wife, Elizabeth Howard Elliott Leach Gren. What do you want me to say? Oh, it has already been explained. Dawns, your voice is gone. Your ears are all right. Stacy mentioned, you'll hear, she has a frog in her throat or something. It's much worse. Okay. Oh, I did forget, and I tell them that the topic of your talk is, I can't, but I will.
I've been whispering all day. This is the first time I've really tried to speak. So, my husband's given me one glass of water. I may need a whole pitcher before I get through. But I have been praying that the Lord will enable me to speak. I spoke yesterday morning and my voice broke halfway through, but I did make it the rest of the way. And I said to Lars just before we came here this evening that it never fails that whatever topic I've chosen, it seems that God will test me precisely on that point. And I chose this topic, of course, long before I knew that I was not going to have a voice. I've been whispering all day. This is the first time I've really tried to speak. So my husband's given me one glass of water. I may need a whole pitcher before I get through. But I have been praying that the Lord will enable me to speak. I spoke yesterday morning and my voice broke halfway through, but I did make it the rest of the way. And I said to Lars just before we came here this evening that it never fails that whatever topic I've chosen, it seems that God will test me precisely on that point. And I chose this topic, of course, long before I knew that I was not going to have a voice. But that is the title that I've given my talk this evening. I can't, but I will. I wonder how many of you know the story of the multiplying of loaves in the Old Testament. Can anyone tell me offhand where that appears? I'm sure that you've all heard of the feeding of the 5,000 and the 4,000 in the New Testament, yes? Yes, you're right. 2 Kings in the 4th chapter. A man came from Baal Shalisha, bringing the man of God, this is Elisha, some of the new season's bread, 20 barley loaves, and fresh, ripe ears of corn. Elisha said, "Give this to the people to eat." But his disciples his disciple protested, "I cannot set this before 100 men." Still he repeated, "Give it to the people to eat, for this is the word of the Lord. They will eat, and there will be some left over." So he set it before them, and they ate and left some over, as the Lord had said. 20 barley loaves and corn on the cob. I've been making a list of the impossibilities in the Bible. I have quite a long list already of questions which were asked of Jesus and of God in the Old Testament. When God commanded something to be done, people raised objections. "There's no way that we can do this. How can I set this before 100 men?" When my brother was about 4 years old, he had a friend across the street who was also four. And whatever my brother could do, the friend could do better, except occasionally. And once in a while, my brother would accomplish something that Joe was unable to do. And when Tommy would challenge Joe to try it, his answer was, "I could, but I don't want to." And I think of us adults when we are asked to do something. Sometimes our answer is, "I would, but I can't." I think that was probably the feeling of the disciple, Elisha's disciple. He would have been happy to feed the people, but there was no way that he could do it with what was provided. "I would, but I can't." In other words, he was willing, but there wasn't any ability. Then, if we're honest with ourselves, I think we would sometimes say, "I could, but I won't." Like my brother's little friend Joe, which it, of course, was not a true answer. "I could, but I don't want to." Very often, it's true that we could do something. We simply don't want to. Then we could say, "I can't and I won't," which means that we have neither the ability nor the willingness. But I'd like us to think tonight about those words, "I can't, but I will." We have no ability, but we have the will to act. And the things that have made me start to think along these lines are things people have said to me just recently. I hear over and over again, this is not recent, but there's hardly a time that I speak about my missionary experience when somebody doesn't come up and say, "Boy, I'm sure glad the Lord didn't call me to be a jungle missionary. Because, you know, I really can't stand snakes." Or, "I've never been able to stand creepy crawlies." Or, "I really don't think I'm the pioneer type." And I'm always amused by that kind of a remark, because I wonder if those people think that the reason that God called me to be a missionary is because I'm particularly fond of snakes and creepy crawlies, and I look to them like the pioneer type. Maybe I do, but I never have felt particularly like the pioneer type, and I can assure you that I'm not very fond of snakes, less fond having lived in the jungle than I was before I got there. I'm not a jumpy female. I'm not the kind to jump on the table if a mouse comes into the room, or to recoil at creepy crawlies particularly, but I'm not crazy about them. And I'm reminded of a friend of mine who is a very wise mother. She's the mother of three small children. And one of the things that she often says to them is, when one of her children says, "But I can't," she says, "When people say they can't, they generally mean they won't." Now think about that. I never could be a missionary. Oh, Lord, I couldn't possibly do that. And I think of my old Bible teacher who told us of a lady who came up to him and said, I think I would just die if the Lord called me to be a missionary. And he said, do both. After all, you won't be much use to anybody in the Lord's work unless you're willing to die first. Jesus said, if you want to be my disciple, you must deny yourself. Another translation says, give up your right to yourself, which is a death, isn't it? Death to self. When people say they can't, they usually mean they won't. And something else that people say to me very often is, how is your daughter and what's she doing now? And I tell them that she's fine. She's the wife of a minister in Mississippi. And as of 2 weeks ago yesterday, she is the mother of five. The oldest is nine. And again, young women who perhaps are the mothers of one or two, or not mothers at all, they say, oh, five children under nine? I could never do that. And several people have said to me, it takes a special woman to be a mother of five. And I would love to be able to have Valerie testify that she's not a special woman. She is simply one who believes that God has called her to be a mother. And I think she's a wonderful mother, and when I watch her operate, I would be inclined to agree with those who are amazed and say that she is a very special woman. And just last week, when I was down there, when the baby was born, I happened to have dinner with her eye doctor, Valerie's eye doctor, and he said to me, you know, I've seen a lot of families in my practice, and they come into my office, and the mobs of kids, and he said, I have never seen a mother that can handle children like your daughter. And of course, I glowed and thanked God again for the grace and the ability that he has given her. But the point that I want to make tonight is that God, I suppose, never calls anyone to do a job for which he feels eminently qualified. Read the biographies of the Bible. In almost every one of the great biographies, the great characters, we find that they were very reluctant and that they protested of their lack of qualifications. You remember the story of Moses. Who, me, Lord? Go down there to Pharaoh? Who am I? He'll never believe me. Who shall I say sent me? I can't speak. And God answered objection after objection after objection. The point was not, who are you? You know, we hear that tired, boring question asked over and over again. Who am I? And I would just like to say to the whole Christian world, would you just forget it? Get off that question forever and ask, whose am I? And then direct your energies not to finding out who you are, but to finding out who God is. Who has called you? And that was the point that God made with Moses. Tell them, I am, has sent you. Jeremiah, he was another one. There was no way that he could do the job of a prophet. He was a very reluctant prophet. And he too protested that he wasn't qualified. He couldn't speak. Then I'd forgotten about Gideon until I reread that story just recently. Gideon belonged to the wrong tribe. He belonged to the wrong family in that tribe. He was the least of the members of his family. "Lord, you've called the wrong man," he said. And we're told that Gideon was afraid, specifically about two different things. And God made a concession to the fear that Gideon felt. And Gideon went down to destroy the altar of his father at night because he was afraid. And then, as for going into the camp of the Midianites, God gave him the opportunity to sneak in and to overhear the story of a dream, which showed him that God was, in fact, going to give him victory. But we could go through many other stories in the Bible where people protested their lack of qualifications. "I would, but I can't." And there are stories of those who could, but they wouldn't. The parable that Jesus gave of the man who had two sons. One of them said he wouldn't go, but he went, and the other one said he would go, but he didn't go. He could, but he didn't. And there were those who couldn't and wouldn't. Are you among the category of those who would say, "I can't, but I will"? If God calls, then God always enables. When I think of God's call to me as a missionary, I felt at first that I was fairly well qualified because I had come from a missionary family. I had been meeting missionaries all my life because one of the great privileges of being the child of my parents was that we had a continual stream of missionaries traipsing through our home. My parents were hospitable, and we had a guest room, and it seemed as though we were continually lugging suitcases up and down the stairs and meeting missionaries at trains in Philadelphia or boats in New York. And we had the privilege of listening at the dinner table to the stories that those missionaries had to tell. We read dozens of missionary books. We looked at thousands of dreadful missionary slides. Slides had not come to their own back in my day. Cameras were complicated, and slides, I can even remember the days of lantern slides, which were huge glass things, and they weren't color, so it was black and white, and it was boring. We went to missionary meetings. I went to Christian schools. I prepared for linguistic work by taking a Greek major in college and then going to the University of Oklahoma and studying linguistics and then going to Bible school. And so I thought that I was fairly well qualified and fairly well prepared. But it didn't take me very long after I got to Ecuador to realize that I wasn't, that there were a whole lot of layers of superficial so-called faith that needed to be stripped off. And God saw to it that in the first year, some of those layers were stripped off in a very painful way. I'm not going to go into those stories tonight. I've written about them in a book called These Strange Ashes. But what God was saying to me was, "I am the Lord. I am the Lord." And reminding me of a promise that he'd given me long before I went to Ecuador. In Isaiah chapter 50, verse 7, "The Lord God will help me. Therefore shall I not be confounded. Therefore have I set my face like a flint, and I know that I shall not be ashamed." And the more I got into missionary work, the less I felt that I knew, and the more afraid I was of the job to which God had called me. And you know, nothing has really changed. The older I get, and the more wisdom God gives me, the more I realize I don't know. The more I realize that there is no qualification in myself. I write books, and I sit down now to my computer. This is the first book that I'm working on right now that I've ever done on a word processor. And I have the feeling every day when I sit down, it's too big a job. What ever gave me the idea that I could write this book? I can't do it. Whenever I get up to speak, I know that my most noble effort, even when my voice is working, is not going to reach people's hearts or people's consciences without the Spirit of God. And I've written down some reminders for myself in the front of this little notebook that I carry around with me. A whole list of verses just to put me in my place and remind me of who it is, whom I serve, and whose I am. In 2 Corinthians, the third chapter, verses 5 and 6, we read, "There is no question of our being qualified in ourselves. We cannot claim anything as our own. The qualification comes from God. It is He who has qualified us to dispense His new covenant." Paul says in Romans 12, "Don't cherish inflated ideas of your own importance, but have a sane estimate of your own capabilities." So in case there's anybody here tonight who is feeling a little bit proud of himself because you feel as though you've really got it made now and you are God's gift to the navigators or to whatever the job is that you think God has called you to, then I've got news for you. There's going to be a process of, I don't want to call it disillusionment, but a process of opening your eyes to reality and to the truth. But my guess is that I'm not talking to very many people in that category. My guess is that I'm talking to people who are thinking, "Oh, I'm not really so sure that I was cut out for this job. How am I supposed to know I was called? I'm not really doing such a bang-up job after all. Maybe I'm going to burn out in a year or so. I don't really feel comfortable in this job." Are you one of those who is saying, "I would, but I can't"? Or will you say to God, "Lord, I know I can't, but by your grace, I will. I will do this thing with your help, by your grace, and for your glory." If you think you're qualified, then you're not really as well qualified as the one who knows that he's not. Because it is my need that brings me to the feet of my Father. It is the child's consciousness of need that brings him in petition to his Father. "Give me, help me, do this, Daddy." You fathers, are you humble enough to be a father? My son-in-law was with my daughter when she gave birth 2 weeks ago. And it's the fifth time that he has been with her in that process. And he said to me afterwards, "It humbles me to the dust every time." He said, "It's so awesome. I know that I'm not worthy to be a father." And someone has said, perhaps it was C.S. Lewis, that one of the reasons God gave us children and animals was to humble us. Because I doubt that any mother, any new mother, any new father can ever look into the face of a child and say, I'm going to make a great mother. I can really do this job. The sight of that child within the first few minutes is going to arouse in you paternal feelings that you didn't know you had never dreamed you had, and maternal feelings which are God's gift, and you may feel a rush of love. I certainly imagine and trust that you will, for that tiny little creature. But I can remember being in tears before the first day was over after my daughter was born, overwhelmed by the consciousness of my inability to do the job, the sense of enormous, awesome responsibility for this human being who was nobody else's in the world. Here was a creature for whom nobody in the world was responsible except my husband and me. Motherhood, fatherhood, what is your job? Are you called to be a missionary? Called to be a pastor? Called to be a spiritual leader? Called to be a man? Called to be a woman? Every one of us is called to one or the other of those. Do you think you can do a bang-up job? Are you womanly? Are you manly? We're not humble enough. We're not perhaps the pioneer type. If God has called you to be the spiritual head of your home, you may prefer to take the back seat, you men, and say, well, my wife is really more spiritual than I am. She ought to do that job. Has God called you to do a job which requires solitude and self-discipline? And you're thinking, oh, I'm not really self-disciplined enough to do a job like that. That's one of the qualities that is required of me as a writer. Nobody's hanging over my shoulder saying, you've got to do this job. Who cares whether I ever write another book or not? Nobody's beating me over the head with a stick. I have to get myself to the desk, turn on the word processor, and start writing day after day after day. I have to sit myself down, take myself by the scruff of the neck, and say, do it. And I imagine that there is some aspect of the work of every single one in this room that requires self-discipline. I hear mothers say, I'm not really patient enough to do a good job as a mother. Nobody is. Patience is one of the fruits of the Spirit. It takes patience to be a husband. It takes patience to be a wife, to be a mother, to be a father, to be a missionary, to work with kids, to work with souls. Patience. We don't have enough of that. And so we say, Lord, I can't, but I will. You've got to give it to me. Do you feel comfortable with the job that God has called you to? I don't see one word in the New Testament that would indicate that discipleship is supposed to be comfortable. Where did we ever get the idea that we have a right to be comfortable? People sometimes ask me that question. Do you really feel comfortable being in a position of authority and visibility, whatever else they might apply to the job that I have to do? My answer is, of course not. You can ask Lars what my recurring dreams are. I think every single one of them can be interpreted as the fear of failure to live up to people's expectations. There's no way that I can do it. But I'm not supposed to feel comfortable. Jesus said, if you want to be my disciple, You give up your right to yourself and you take up your what? Your cross. We follow one who was crucified. There's nothing comfortable about a cross. In the next chapter of 2 Kings, the fifth chapter, we have a very story which probably is much more familiar to most of you, the story of Naaman the leper. You remember that Naaman was told that there was a prophet in another kingdom who could probably heal his leprosy. And that very proud, prominent man was humbled step by step. For one thing, it was, first of all, a little servant girl who had the clue to the one who could heal him, a little captive from the land of Israel. She said, if only my master could meet the prophet who lives in Samaria, he would get rid of the disease for him. And then he went to the king of Israel, and the king of Israel was appalled because he certainly had no ability to heal him himself. And then Elisha heard how the king had rent his clothes in dismay, and he sent to him and said, why did you rend your clothes? Let the man come to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel. And so when Naaman came with his impressive retinue, you remember that Elisha did not even come out of the house to meet him, but sent a messenger. Here was Naaman with horses and chariots and a long retinue of servants. And Elisha sent a messenger out to say, if you will go and wash 7 times in the Jordan, your flesh will be restored and you will be clean. And Naaman was furious and went away saying, I thought he would at least have come out and stood and invoked the Lord his God by name, waved his hand over the place, and so rid me of the disease. Are not Abana and Parphar, rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Can I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and went off in a rage. But his servants came up to him and said, if the prophet had bidden you do something difficult, would you not do it? How much more then if he tells you to wash and be clean? So here was a case of I could, but I won't. It's unthinkable that I, as a king, should be humiliated in this way, that the prophet would not so much as come out of the house and would not do any of the ways, things that he expected him to. Thank you. But would send me down to wash in that filthy river. Haven't we got better ones? To me, this is a wonderful illustration. Thank you. Of the fact that so often we have our own ideas of how God is supposed to answer our prayers. We have footnotes that we offer to God, making suggestions about the way we would like to see a certain thing done. Or our own agenda of what we would like to do for God. I've been writing a biography of a missionary in India named Amy Carmichael. And Amy Carmichael made it crystal clear to every prospective recruit that they would be expected to do anything that was asked of them. She made it so clear that it's really quite marvelous that anybody ever came to India, because she did her very best to turn them aside. She said, we don't want anyone here who can be turned aside. We can offer you no glamour, nothing interesting, no excitement, only a place to die. That is what we are offering. And in the very short list of questions that she sent to prospective recruits were these two. Does the thought of hardness attract or repel you? I'd like you to think about your answer to that one. And secondly, is the cross the attraction? It's easy to deceive ourselves into thinking that we want to serve God, when the truth is that we want distinction. We want a job which will perhaps be praised, which has at least a title and a job description. There were no job descriptions in Amy Carmichael's work in India. Everyone was a member of the family, and in a family, you do whatever needs to be done. And there were many who came having answered all the questions as she wanted them to. And when they got there, they found out that even though they had thought they were prepared to do anything, there were things asked of them that they could not do. But the spirit was, I can't, but I will. I had to deliver babies when I was a missionary. I had no medical training of any kind. When you suddenly discover that you're the only person within 100 miles who has both clean hands and common sense, then you find out that you have to do a whole lot of medical work that you never had any idea of doing. When my husband Jim died, I had to try to learn to do a whole lot of things that he had learned to do, which I never dreamed of having to do, such as running the diesel generator that provided electricity for the station where he and I had been working. I had to try to be a foreman of 40 Indians who swung machetes and kept our airstrip open. My husband had been helping with the school and the church and the cooperative shop that he had started for the Indians to try to help them to learn to handle money. And all of these things were dropped in my lap. And it was a case of progressive recognition of my need of God. I need thee every hour. There's never a minute when I'm not in need of the grace of God. In the first case, where the disciples said, how can I feed them? I would, but I can't. It was the people's need that was at stake. And they would be the losers if the man was not obedient. In the second case, it was the king's own need. And he would be the loser if he was disobedient. I want to say just one more thing to you tonight on this subject. Your obedience matters. Your obedience to God matters not only to you. It is the path of joy. I have found more joy, it says in Psalm 119:45. I have found more joy along the path of thy instruction than in any kind of wealth. Your obedience will matter to you. I'm absolutely convinced that fulfillment and joy and satisfaction are not to be found anywhere in the universe except in the will of God. And when the will of God looks scary to you, just remember, God means exactly what he says. In thy presence is fullness of joy. At thy right hand there are pleasures forevermore. But I have found that my obedience matters to other people. I could have figured out for myself that it certainly matters to my husband. He has to live with me. And the more obedient I am to God, the easier I will be to live with. It certainly matters to my daughter. The more obedient I am to God, the better mother I make. And now I'm a grandmother. And I realize that that is an awesome responsibility too. But the obedience is like a pebble dropped into a lake. You never know where those ripples are going to stop. I have had people again and again come up to me and say, thank you for your obedience. I don't even know what they're talking about. But somewhere they picked up something, either in a book that I'd written or something that I'd said, and that thing mattered to them. Now, you may not write books, and you may not become a public speaker, but take my word for it. Your obedience matters. Whatever it is that God is asking of you tonight, I trust that before Him, in quietness, alone, you will honestly be able to say, I can't, but I will. God bless you.